But welcome, Kelly.
Thank you.
And Kelly is the co-director of the Initiative for Energy Justice, a research organization that translates complex energy topics into actionable insights for communities and policymakers. She's been advocating for climate and clean energy solutions for 25 years. Kelly also serves on the Community Advisory Board for Energize NC, the state's Solar for All program. And so we're so happy to have you. I just remember that one time I buttonholed you at a Sierra Club march, and that was about 10 years ago that I first met you. I don't know if you remember that, but in any case, it's been nice to work with you on the Energy Innovation Task Force and also here on the Climate Bus. So welcome back to the Climate Bus.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
I'm loving it because we've never officially met, and I guess I'm filling your shoes. So can you tell me a little bit about your work today and what that looks like?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me here today. These days I work for the Initiative for Energy Justice. We're housed out of Northeastern University, and we provide policy analysis and participatory action research. So we do research in partnership with communities that help identify, like, in the weeds, answers to complex energy problems, things like community benefits or the Solar for All program, for example, which is what we'll be talking about, I think, later today. And so it's a little bit different role for me. I have spent most of my career more in advocacy and campaigning. And so this is more detail-oriented policy and research. And it's been really fun.
Well, and Kelly, for the audience, tell us a little bit about, I mean, that's your current role, but you've got to, you know, what was home for you? How did you get into the clean energy movement, and what brings you this full circle?
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, I became, you know, to be honest, my journey started when I was in college many moons ago in Vermont. And I remember sitting in a huge lecture hall in my Intro to Environmental Studies course, and my professor was on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the entity of scientists who really have been documenting the impacts of climate change and the need to take action. And this was, you know, 25 years ago or something. And I had never really heard about global warming at that point. And as I sat there, I was like, man, this sounds catastrophic. And we've got to do something about this. And the people that are making decisions are sitting in the boardrooms of utility companies and oil companies, and they are our government officials in the state houses and in the halls of Congress, and they have names and phone numbers, and we can talk to them, and we can organize, and we can make a difference. And it really, I've never fully looked back. So there's been lots of roles in between, but that was a really defining moment for me. So here locally, I've lived in Asheville since 1999 and helped be part of there was a years ago clean energy business task force that was when I worked for Congressman Heath Shuler when he represented this area, and we brought stimulus money to the area for energy retrofits and for rural clean energy and to incubate clean energy businesses and things like that. I was part of helping to retire the coal plant, Duke Energy's coal plant, and that campaign and building public support for that. And then what became the Energy Innovation Task Force, where I met you, Brad, worked for the Sierra Club, and eventually my work took me more nationally. So I
is this
more national
work today? Is it at the federal level, state level, local, all of the above, the policy advocacy?
Yeah, it is. We have a little bit of work in each of those pieces. Not so much local yet, although I would love to. I'm trying to find partnerships to build locally. Yeah.
And so federally, how does that work in this current administration and climate? Is it require kind of different initiatives altogether, or is your work stay kind of consistent at the policy level? Like, I don't quite have my brain wrapped around how much an administration can influence your work.
Well, one of the pivots that we have had now is really documenting some of the practices and policies that were put in place during the Biden-Harris administration, such as especially some of the specifics under the Inflation Reduction Act. And one of those is Solar for All. So we are, that's a $7 billion program that helps communities and low-income communities access solar. And so
is it under threat right now?
Yeah.
Or the funding is under threat?
For
is it a
sure.
clawback?
Yeah, it is. And so one of the things we're doing, though, is documenting over the long term what that program is. You know, there's so much energy and effort and work and money that went into many of these programs that we're working to document those. So what's it look like long term? What was built? And then in real time, what's happening? But it's less about, our work isn't as much about the legal, we're not doing like the legal cases to prevent the rollback as much as we are really documenting and hearing from people about how these programs are impacting them, how the rollbacks might impact them, so that we are preserving that and not starting from scratch next time around, right? So similar, you know, we get into the weeds about like what do community benefits look like for large scale renewable energy programs? How does that work if you're a community and you're trying to get community benefits agreements? What kind of template or blueprint is there out there? Those are the types of things we do on the federal level. So of course it's changed because it's more, you know, just instead of
trade winds are blowing.
And so instead of documenting. Instead of being able to document like huge successes, we're documenting how do you navigate when there's such a pendulum swing, right? And then state level, we have looked at the justice provisions within the top 10 states that have 100% clean energy laws. So we provide like a scorecard for energy justice. So looking at the intersection of where justice-centered measures, so like who benefits from clean energy kind of stuff.
What kind of score does North Carolina have?
Well, we don't have 100% clean energy law, so we didn't look at
those.
We did the top 10 that have laws in place, goals in place for 100%
now, is that, clean energy. Is that 100% clean energy in the utility sector or overall?
They vary, right. But it's, each state does them a little bit different.
Duke's 100% goal on the carbon plan doesn't qualify for, that's not a state energy goal then, that's just a one utility?
Yeah, I also think it's a timing. Our 100% clean energy evaluation might have been right as the carbon plan was getting going.
So you just said we're going to look at these states. And
yeah,
then
we just picked 10 states right. to evaluate.
Who are the winners, the champions that we should just be so cheering on?
It is the states. Let's see. I don't know if we picked a winner or if we ranked them. Yeah. We more did a scorecard to look at who can access clean energy and how will low-income families be able to access solar? Who will benefit from
energy justice play into
correct.
That clean energy
correct.
Goal?
So we didn't necessarily rank them, but the type of states that we looked at were Washington, New York, Vermont.
Very cool.
California, I would guess, is
California.
In there.
California,
they tend to be progressive states.
Yeah,
I
sure. You know, you have to be a little bit progressive to.
You shouldn't have to be progressive.
You should not have to be.
You're right.
I
but
agree.
That's just the way it's
currently
turned out,
played
but,
out. Currently,
but really, conservatives
out.
Should be all in favor of solving
Absolutely.
The climate crisis as well.
Absolutely, and having more people benefit from clean energy, right?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, we just saw. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this. What just came out a new report that 90,000 deaths a year are caused by pollution from fossil fuels in the U.S. It was a report. I can pull it up. I had it on my list of articles for this show.
But 90,000?
90,000 a year.
Like respiratory, that type of...
Respiratory, cancer, the incidence of cancer. It's not just the deaths. It's also the health care costs. That something like hundreds of thousands of asthma cases mm-hmm. are caused by the climate pollution or made much worse by the carbon pollution, but the soot, the particulates, the ozone, just the bad air that we have because of all the fossil fuel burning that
That's
we're doing.
Right.
So the side benefits of solving the climate crisis are huge in terms of public health.
Absolutely.
I mean, we lose 40,000 people a year from traffic accidents. Now, just think about how much money we spend publicly to avoid the deaths on the highway, the extent to which we re-engineer and try to keep down the number of deaths by all the protective measures, by all of the expense that we take to avoid deaths. And yet this is something that's causing twice as many deaths per year as all highway accidents.
Well, and the inequities of wherever all of this is manufactured, right?
The energy justice side of it is it's even worse for people that live close to the facilities in proximity to the production equipment. I mean, everybody is affected, but some people are affected more, and those tend to be, you know, people of color and
vulnerable,
people of lower
income.
People, you know, because property prices are lower and people can afford to live more easily when you're right up next to one of those polluting power plants and power sources.
Well, it's also by design, right? The polluting industries have targeted more marginalized communities and communities of color for locating their polluting.
They get less
voice, no agency.
Yeah. And so then the health impacts on Black and Brown Americans are more severe. So when we look at the asthma rates or the pollution, where many communities of color are literally metabolizing that pollution through their through their bodies and causing more harm. Right.
Well, I do want to hear more about Solar for All.
Yeah.
And what it was trying to do, and how are you tracking it now? And what's the latest? I mean, as I remember, it was something designed specifically for energy justice because the benefits were going to go to people of low income, if I recall.
Yeah, and hopefully still will. So Solar for All is a $7 billion national program that came out of the Inflation Reduction Act that granted this money out to 60 programs across the state, across the country, including a $160 million into North Carolina.
To subsidize solar costs to make it affordable?
It goes to help low-income communities access solar. And then the grantees, the 60 grantees across the country, design programs that best meet the needs of their constituents. And so here in North Carolina, that is being designed to enable communities to access solar or solar and storage. So those have the major benefits here are in reducing home energy costs, expected to reduce costs. It's expected in North Carolina to benefit some 12,000 households and reduce energy costs by about 20%. And so we know that low-income communities pay the highest percentage of their income on electric bills as compared to wealthier Americans. And so reducing bills has all kinds of benefits because it frees up money in low-income households to spend on other needs. And that is the other big benefit is around workforce development. So North Carolina, as y'all know, we employ some 9,000 people in the solar industry across approximately 200 businesses. And so the Solar for All program enables, you know, more job creation and more economic benefit and workforce development in the clean energy industry. And so, yes, it's at threat. It's threatened right now. The administration sent notices to all of the grantees announcing a termination of the program. And like many of these termination letters for other programs in the IRA, under the IRA, it is, you know, questionably legal.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have access to people suing and pushing back?
There hasn't been a lawsuit filed yet, but I would say that, again, like many of these programs that have been stopped because the funds have already been obligated and it's on
congressionally
shaky.
Too, right? In many cases.
Yes. Yeah. So it's questionable about whether the administration has that kind of authority.
We can pick this up on the other side of the break if that sounds good to you guys.
That sounds great.
All right.
Sounds great.
Right.
Thanks.
See you all in a minute.
Listening to Asheville FM 103.3 in Asheville, and programming support is being brought to you by Wist. It's an independent, locally owned shop specializing in greeting cards and gifts for any occasion. Located at 444 Haywood Road in West Asheville, Wist is open Monday through Saturday. More information is available on wistshop.com or on Instagram and Facebook. And we're in the middle of climate buzz and picking it up where we left off. Lisa.
Yeah, just when we went to break, I was saying to Kelly, like, we were just talking about the canceling of all this awarded money. And I said, you know, how do you kind of live in that space? And you were sharing that you've really kind of had a paradigm shift in how you think about this work and that you're leaning more into visualizing maybe and manifesting the future you want versus mired down in generations of kind of maybe us having anger against the world from an environmental perspective. So I think this is really valuable and powerful to speak to. So will you share a little bit kind of what you were saying and maybe what led you to this place after you've had a whole career in this space?
Sure. I mean, don't get me wrong.
There are days.
I definitely feel infuriated at many, many points, right, on what feels like a very intentional and willful, destructive practice.
Retaliatory, yeah.
Okay. Especially by the fossil fuel industry and then by the electeds who are beholden to them and who are choosing that route. But I also feel like, I guess it's two things. One is strategically, you know, scientists have been sounding the alarm for decades and decades, and we are not getting as far as quickly as we need to avoid the worst impacts of the climate crisis. But the other, so I wonder if perhaps painting the picture of what it looks like to live in a clean, healthy community that is powered by solar energy and energy, you know, we have energy efficient homes and where we can have walkable, livable communities. And
if we were Danish, transit. Perhaps. I'm just thinking, keep going.
Yeah. But like, what, you know, what could that look like? And part of it is just about grasping onto my own joy in these times that are quite dire and quite scary to live in at the confluence of not only living through the climate crisis and the impacts of that, like Hurricane Helene, but also the compounding issues of rising authoritarianism and attacks on immigrants and all the other pieces, it can get you down. And that is, I think, by design. And part of our resilience, not only resilience ecologically, but our personal resilience is about being able to hold on to our joy and our vision of
the future we want to see.
Yeah.
The future we want to see.
I like that a lot because even, you know, I can read the book, The Secret, but at some point the universe, you know, will reflect back what you put out. And to your point, there's a whole lot of us that want to put out a world that's equitable and really environmentally balanced and sound. And in all of this, it is designed to put us on the defense and make us feel angry and helpless. And I think you're spot on to try to hang on to where do we want to be, champion where we want to be, share that vision, and hang on to the positiveness that goes around that and try to get out of this reactionary space.
Yeah. And it's not an either or, yeah, right? It's
sure.
not a, you know, sometimes we're pushed into this either or environment. And it's really not about that. It's more of a both and, right? Like we can, it is definitely super important to march in the streets and raise our voices and call our elected officials and run for office, and all those pieces are super important. And it's important to channel our anger into action. And it's also important to hold on to our joy. I mean, I love, you said you were fly fishing this weekend, right? I love swimming. I love swimming all in the rivers and the lakes around here. I love being outside. It's what originally got me into environmental work, is just the love for the outdoors. And so making sure we do those things that bring us the joy and the center us in the natural world helps us be more effective.
We're so fortunate here, right? Because all you have to do is step outside to experience awe and wonder. I mean, I just moved from Colorado, another exquisite place, 4 years ago, but I literally have to use, picture this, my plant identification app in my backyard, because our yard has so many seasons of plants that bloom and flourish. And I'm just like, my God, what are you? You know, it's one of the most spectacular places on earth where we live. And to be able to just step outside, breathe it in, you know, honor it, I think is really critical in our ongoing mental health at this moment in time.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it sounds a little bit like that's kind of taking a break, though, from it. I mean, you know, what you have to do, right? You have to take a break, or you have to re-gear, recharge your battery.
Maybe just balance it. I don't think so much that it's stepping away, but I think it's every minute you can, you know, pick to look outside and be like, my God, it's spectacular out there. You know, and I think just to incorporate, to be mindful about incorporating that in throughout.
Well, I think.
And then you go eat cicadas.
Well, but that's just that we're all part of the web of life. Yeah. And cicadas are part of the web of life. I mean, the cicadas were spectacular in their own way that was maybe a little bit inconvenient, but the fact that every 17 years they come out and they make this loud noise for a month that you can hardly even hear, that's like, what is this power equipment running in my yard?
Yeah,
and then they're gone, and yet we can still eat them. And the bears, that looks like a bear got into a trash can just down the street here. You know, I mean,
rather a meat cicadas.
Right.
I learned during the cicada season, and Lisa, you probably know this because you're a water person, but that they bore these holes so deep down that it helps the water percolate into
their
water table.
They're aerators.
Yeah.
Oh, they're aerators.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not know that. But I had to, when they were starting to get on my nerves, I had to look at
all the wonders.
Okay, what are they doing right now? And I thought that was pretty cool.
But I just, you know, to segue, but you know, what's the, you know, when you're back on the job or when you're back on the mission, you know, what is that future that you visualize? How do you visualize? Because I just think, I mean, and I brought this up last week that I was meeting and had a presentation for these teenagers at a Jewish community center, actually. And and they've got, and I know you felt this when you were in school, 80 years here on this planet, 70 years here on this planet, well beyond what I have left. And they have to visualize a future that works for them.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that? That future, when you visualize it, when you're trying to get back to that vision of the future, what is that? What's your elevator speech on that future?
I mean, we could probably make an elevator speech together. We all have solutions, and I believe that we already know technologically the solutions that keep us in balance with the environment. So, and that it's just the political will that the building and the financing of it as well. So, you know, I envision solar everywhere. I envision solar on rooftops and buildings. I envision wind. I envision plants and local food and gardens everywhere. I see sidewalks and electric buses and people walking places and electric vehicles. I see healthy rivers. I see areas, riparian areas along the rivers that buffer from storms and allow for natural floodplains and water catchments that, you know, make it less severe when we do flood. Those are the types of things that I picture. I see.
And there are places in the world who like that. I'm imagining that description, and there's places in the world who have evolved to something that embodies a lot of that. So it can be done, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one more thing is that I see that as a community that everybody can live in too. I see less extremes of this inequity of wealth where people have to grind in order to just make ends meet, right? I see more relaxation, a slower lifestyle, right? Where no one is left behind, where everyone can access, you know, food and drinking water and energy.
I think I like this a lot, and I keep thinking too where it all begins. And, you know, America has, you know, so many extraordinary features. And I think capitalism and private property rights drive us here. And I enjoy both of those rights. That's not a judgment. Whoa, my sound went in and out of one ear and the other. Am I out?
No, you're here.
I'm here. Oh, we just lost Kelly. Okay. Oh, wait, we're back. Woo.
We're back.
But I keep thinking about, I love that you brought up riparian zones and thinking about more, you know, how can we look at our floodplains? Because what's been hugely on my mind post-Helene is Like, we've just got to prepare to get wet, and we have to lean into that and own it. And I think it goes with everything, right? Like, we have this tendency to deny or to try to justify to ourselves, like, oh, hey, that was just a 1,000-year event or a 500-year event, back to business as usual. Or, you know, the climate warming and the shifting of weather patterns, like, we try to deny it. And I think one of the greatest things we need to do is start to lean into our realities and then prepare accordingly, right? Because if we recognize, I'm getting ready to do a whole new presentation scenario, and it literally, chapter one is, prepare to get wet. Like, we've got to recognize the enormous shared responsibility it is to be in floodplains. And if we're going to be there, and over time, maybe we phase out being there, because if you have enough big events, there is sort of natural attrition, if you will. But when we stay, like, we've got to stay with resilience. We've got to build for it. We've got to share it amongst everyone. Like, if we're the property owner or the building owner and we have tenants, like, it needs to be in our jurisdictions. Like, if our zoning allows us to be in floodplains, we need preparedness. So I think this concept goes across everything. Like, can we own things differently? Because I think we tend to not want to imagine them as our reality, and we just keep doing business as usual. And the planet is changing dramatically in terms of her extreme response to things.
Yeah, I love that you say that. It makes me think of community solar projects, and where, you know, here locally we have solar that is on many of the schools in the county, in Buncombe County, and there's all kinds of ways to design community solar projects. We have at Initiative for Energy Justice, we have a evaluation also of all these different kinds of community solar, so people can go there and look about how you can design projects that have shared, you know, the best ones have shared ownership, so people get financial benefits as well. In North Carolina, that's a little trickier because of our utility monopoly with Duke Energy, but there's all kinds of ways that we can use community or owned property, public property, to be able to, have solar projects, which is a great solution.
That's a big one here, because we're fortunate to live somewhere so progressive, and I think if we can't do these things in public spaces, how do we ever expect to do them in private spaces? And so I think those examples of, like, county schools having solar initiatives are perfect. We're on kind of a big campaign of, for these river parks that are city or county owned, can we please put less infrastructure in them as we rebuild them and make them much more passive? Like, yes, enjoy them, recreate in them, but find higher ground for the heavy infrastructure. Because if we can't do that in the public space arena, how is it that we ask a private property owner mm-hmm. to do something different in the floodplain?
Yeah.
So, and we're fortunate to live somewhere where we have a lot of local leaders, I think, that care a lot, and just getting the public to come along in those spaces. Because we have to change our behavior and our perception of things, or we're just going to keep repeating and looking for a different outcome. And that is the definition of insanity, by the way. Yeah, and our investments.
Well,
public and private investments, right? That financing is super important.
I think it's all well and good, but we haven't seen anything yet. And there are certain scenarios of the future that we cannot prepare for.
What do you mean when you say we haven't seen anything yet?
We haven't seen the storms. We haven't seen the drought. We haven't seen the tornadoes. We haven't seen the weather disruption that is possible if we continue down the path of our energy dependence on fossil fuels.
I would offer a friendly amendment that I do think we're seeing it. Like, I think there's no way we can say we lived through Helene that we haven't seen it yet.
No.
I hear what you're saying, which is, I think what you're saying is
she's just getting warmed up.
It's only going to get worse.
It's only going to get worse. Right. We haven't seen the worst, and we have to do something about the underlying cause. We cannot just adapt.
I think it's a both and, though, right? We better start adapting ASAP, because that is our current reality.
Right.
And yes, we better recognize. I mean, I've been fascinated just watching the rainfall behavior lately. Like, it's very common now. Well, the month of August, right? We continually get these 1 to 2 inch localized rain events in an hour or under.
Right.
The micro flooding around here, like last week alone, you know, you can get that kind of stormwater cannot be managed with the existing systems for that kind of rain. And to your point, like these are normalized now, right? Like I talked to neighbors that have lived in our neighborhood for 20 or 30 years in Black Mountain, and they're like, we've never seen the volume and intensity of rain in like half an hour that we're seeing now. So yeah, but we better adapt while we go, because in the absence of adaption, we're going to continue to run up $60 billion price tags and using all these resources to try to put stuff back together again. Something's got to give in how we approach this today, let alone long term and taking action for tomorrow.
Yeah.
I think on a Monday morning. That's what I have to say about that.
I'm with you on the both and.
Yeah, well, we have to do both and at this point. I mean, there was a point where we had the luxury of just doing the mitigation, the prevention, the long-term prevention. We didn't take that opportunity, or we didn't take it strongly enough, and now we're in a situation. You talk about some countries possibly having made the shift and to a more sustainable future, and I'm afraid that the data just, and that's the data that I wanted to share this morning in answer to your question last week, the data that, you know, of the globally, you know, we're, and, you know, this goes back to the whole idea of, well, what's the vision of the future? And one of the visions of the future is that we have to be 100% electric or virtually 100% electric in all of our energy use. And right now, globally, we're at about 25. And the best countries in the world, I think Norway, I can't remember what the statistic for Norway was, but it may be 38, 40% electric. And that means for the other parts of your energy, you're using fossil fuel. So, you know, we're using fossil fuel in our cars. We use fossil fuel in our homes. We're using fossil fuels in our industry. We're using fossil fuels to make fertilizers. We're using fossil fuels to make cement. We're doing, you know, we're shipping goods across the country. And those, many of those are available to be converted to electric. But, you know, when, and you had asked how we were relative to other countries. The U.S., I think, was around 23%. China is the world leader, and they're 27. You know, so it's a big, huge thing. Now, I will say, does that mean, you know, the question that you ought to be asking is, or a normal person would say, well, if we're only 25% electric, does that mean we need four times as much electricity to go to 100? Because that's a huge...
No.
It doesn't. And that's what I asked you about this before. It doesn't mean that at all, but that's what the naysayers, the people who say we can't do this, would have you believe, right? You need four times as much electricity. We can't possibly get there. Let's don't even try. You know, do you want that many solar panels? Do you want that much of a grid infrastructure, that many transmission lines? And the answer is no. The people who have studied this have identified that there's a fallacy called the primary energy fallacy, which says that 25% of your energy is electric. If you want to go all electric, you're foolhardy to think we can do it because you got to quadruple the amount of electricity. No, because electricity is so much more efficient that if we doubled our electricity, or even less than a double, we could handle all of those other energy needs. So total energy consumption would drop dramatically. Electricity, honestly, really is more like 50 or 60% of what really matters, which is what is delivering the goods that energy provides, like heat, cooling, transportation, lighting, motors, electricity, you know, and the perfect example is an electric car takes 1/5 to 1/4 of the energy of a gas car. And so that's the big distinction for that.
Yeah.
And Jim,